Make sure to celebrate mom on both Mother's Day and El Día de las Madres. So don't overthink it and get her the new Samsung Galaxy S7 for zero down with AT&T Next. Porque mom deserves a gift big enough for both days. AT&T, mobilizing your world. Requires well-qualified credit, installment agreement, and service. Balance due if service canceled. Taxes, activation, or upgrade, and other fees, charges, and restrictions apply. Visit att.com/next for details.
Welcome to Human Lab, the science between us. This is Amy Elkon, science-based, nationally syndicated columnist and your host. And stay tuned for a very interesting half hour with my guest, cognitive neuroscientist Dr. Colin Ellard, who will reveal how our surroundings impact how we feel, act, and out of that, the sort of people we are day to day. So the last place I lived in New York City was Tribeca. Right at what I called the rectum of New Jersey. I'm just speechless even talking about it. It was horrible. The Holland Tunnel. It was at the middle of nowhere edge of downtown Manhattan. Now, I left New York before 9/11, but when I did live there, I used the World Trade Center as my landmark to get home. I'd look up, I'd find it, and I'd point myself that way. So the World Trade Center architecturally, it was a big white elephant to many people, I think. But as I told somebody recently, it was our white elephant, and its loss from New York skyline to me has denuded the skyline and taken away something big from it. Now, because the building wasn't important to me personally, I didn't really even think too much about the architecture. I didn't realize how important it actually was until it was gone. And it turns out that we all have these complex but actually psychologically understandable feelings about our environments and the buildings and the other elements in them. Tonight, we will look at the psychology behind these feelings and why we evolved to feel as we do. My guest is cognitive neuroscientist Colin Ellard, and his very interesting book is Places of the Heart, The Psychogeography of Everyday Life. I promise you, after this show, you will not look at your environment or other environments the same way, and we will also leave you with some tips so you can shift your own environment so you live out better, happier, more relaxed, yet more engaged days. Hello, Colin.
Hi, Amy.
Hi, coming to us from Waterloo in Canada. Your book is about psychogeography, how our surroundings influence us. I can't talk tonight. You say that the extent to which our surroundings influence us has been underestimated.
Yeah, I think that's really true. I think it's something that very much in our day-to-day lives we kind of take for granted. You know, you walk the same routes, you inhabit the same places, and you kind of forget that everything that surrounds you, all of the sensations, the visual sensations, the things that you hear, touch, and smell, all of that is having an influence on you all of the time.
And now, we humans, we've long thought of ourselves as rational animals, but recently behavioral economists have been dispelling that, and you talk about what USC neuroscientist Antonio Damasio calls somatic markers, which we know better as gut feelings. So tell us how our surroundings speak to us and influence our judgment.
Well, I think, you know, if you look at the history of psychology and folk psychology, still, I think, to a great extent, we talk about this kind of division between the heart and the mind, as though we've got this kind of super rational consciousness that we use to make decisions, and then underneath that, we've got this kind of seething mess of emotions that interfere with our rational thought processes. And I think, you know, the work of Damasio and many others has kind of overturned that idea to help us to understand that a lot of our rationality, including our decision-making, is very much influenced by our emotional state and should be. So that's very much a factor in what happens when we think about our interactions with our environment. The environment that we're in will directly influence our feeling state, and that in turn will influence the kinds of decisions that we make, the kinds of thought processes that we have.
I think that this is very important. People don't understand this. You talk about how our actions motivate our emotions. And you say this quote, we feel because we do. And it turns out that in generating how we feel, posture matters, like whether we're standing up straight or slouching.
Yeah, that's very true. And there are all kinds of examples of that I could tell you about. The one that springs to mind, it's kind of a weird one because it's something that just happened to me, but it was just Halloween, obviously, yesterday. And in the run-up to Halloween, I went to visit one of these kind of hokey haunted house experiences. And I noticed that one of the ways that they invoke kind of fear and anxiety in those settings is that they deliberately manipulate your posture. So there are times in this this amusement park where you basically have to hunch over into a defensive crouch to get from one place to another. And getting yourself into that defensive crouch will actually elicit the kinds of feelings that you might have if you were actually trying to defend yourself from a threat. So the action in that case has actually preceded the emotion state.
And you talk about how this we feel because we do spills over into our relationships with built structures, so buildings and other built structures. And you give this fascinating example of the Holocaust.
Sorry, you just cut out there, Amy. I didn't quite hear what you
okay.
said.
Okay, it's the
that's
Holocaust.
Just the last
you
part.
Talk about the. Okay, you were talking about
yes.
the Holocaust news. Oh, it's so interesting the way you describe it and how it feels to go through it.
Yeah, the Holocaust Memorial in Berlin. When you kind of look at it from the outside, what you see is just kind of a field of concrete blocks, and you think, as you're standing there looking at it, what the heck? You know, how is this a memorial to anything? And what's interesting about it is that you actually have to go into the field, go into this sea of blocks to experience the effect. And what happens is that the alleyways between the blocks that you walk through are narrow. In my case, I walked through the memorial with my wife, and we immediately became separated. And so we immediately began to feel this sort of sense of isolation. You're in this massive structure, but you can't really see other people very often. And then from time to time, as you're walking past intersections, you're absolutely skewered by these long sight lines to the outside world that make you feel as though you're suddenly exposed. So I think that this was a Peter Eisenman design. I think his intent in that design was not so much to give you something to look at from the outside, but to give you something that you actually have to go into and experience. And when you do, the kinds of feelings that get elicited, that kind of combination of disorientation, isolation, and the occasional skewering by those long alleyways standing as kind of a proxy for surveillance, it puts you into a miserable state pretty quickly. And it didn't take very much walking through that memorial before I was in tears, as all of the feelings kind of resonated with the associations that had to do with the intent of the memorial. I got the whole thing, but only by being in it and interacting with it.
Wow, that to me is a successful building. That's really amazing the way you describe it.
No kidding. So a great, great building doesn't always have to be a happy place.
Right, you know, right. Because you're talking about this, how these buildings make us do, make us feel. It's so, so interesting how our feelings are so impacted by our environments. And I really don't think that people realize it. And so you write about how most of us now live in environments very detached from the natural environments in which we evolved. And there's this value to being around greenery. And you give the example of researcher Roger Ulrich's study of hospital patients. So tell us about that.
Yeah, Roger Ulrich's study several decades ago now was really kind of ground zero for probably what's now the biggest movement in environmental psychology. What he did, it was a fairly simple study, but he went into a hospital and he studied gallbladder patients. And he had two samples of patients. One sample had in their rooms, they had views through their windows of natural scenes. They could see some grass, they could see some trees. and the other group didn't. The other group basically could see concrete and bricks from their windows. And what Ulrich did was to measure hard variables like the amount of analgesic, the amount of pain relief that the two groups of patients needed, and how long they stayed in hospital after the surgery. And he discovered that there was a significant difference between the two groups. The groups that had the views of nature from their windows, one would think a fairly subtle, you know, certainly not an immersive experience with nature, just a view, they recovered more quickly and needed less pain meds than the other group. Since that time, there's been an absolute avalanche of research showing in all kinds of interesting ways that there's something almost magical about exposure to nature in any form, again, from a modest experience, just a view, sitting on a bench in an urban parquet for 10 minutes, all the way up to taking a walk through the forest. All of those things act on our brains and our bodies to produce what's called a restorative response. So our arousal levels go down, our secretion of stress-related hormones like cortisol decreases, our mental state changes, even the way that we pay attention to the world shifts when we're in those kinds of settings, and for some time afterwards.
That is so incredible. And I had actually read that Ulrich study a long time back, and it changed the way I live and work. I started to go for walks with my tiny little dog down this very sort of leafy walk street. And some people know who've listened to the show, I have ADD or ADHD, whatever it is. And so I had worked in this area where I covered all the windows where I would just be able to see my desk. And I changed that so I can see plants outside. And then I have a plant, it's dying. My plants all commit suicide, but it's behind my computer. So I have some greenery there because I realized how important it was. I thought maybe it'll make me a little smarter, a little more efficient, a little less stressed out, like you're saying.
Yeah, that's great that you were able to adapt your behavior and your habits to take that kind of thing into account. You know, all too often I think we don't do that. I think, you know, if you look at, for example, the way that some people think about greenery in cities, we tend to often think of it as kind of an aesthetic, just kind of a bauble that we add on to the city after we take care of all of the fundamentals like the transportation network and the plumbing and the electricity and the economy. But understanding how important these kinds of exposures to green spaces are kind of brings to the forefront the fact that having this kind of stuff in cities is absolutely fundamental. And you can actually measure the impact of good landscape architecture in cities in public health terms. So, for example, there was a study that came out, I think it was last year, that actually measured the effect of boulevard trees on streets, on people's health, on public health variables like the incidence of cardiac disorders and diabetes. And what that study showed was that just adding as little as 10 boulevard trees to a city block can produce a measurable impact. It actually changes one's lifespan and reduces the incidence of these debilitating chronic diseases. So, you know, when you're thinking about how you get from point A to point B in a city or a neighborhood, then if you actually think consciously about planning a route that may not necessarily be the shortest route from one place to another, but takes you through areas that have this kind of nature exposure, then incrementally over the course of your life, I think it's going to have an impact. It's not only going to make you happier, but it's going to make you healthier.
Yeah, it is so important to pay attention to this stuff. And I'm all about applied science. Now, I have a question for you. Fake plants. Do we fool ourselves with fake plants?
Yeah, I think we do. You know, I think that the key elements in natural scenes that cause these kinds of restorative effects are, if they're good fake plants, they're going to be there. And the research that we've done in our lab suggests that a lot of what drives the restorative response visually has to do with the kinds of patterns that you find in scenes of nature. And you can produce those not only by using real nature, but also by using any other kinds of displays that might have those same kinds of patterns in them. So, for example, one of the studies that we did early on was, in some ways it sounds sort of icky if you love nature, but we produced virtual reality versions of natural scenes. And we did an experiment where we put people into a miserable state when they came into the lab. It turns out that psychologists are really good at making people feel crappy. And so we did a crack job of that. And then we put people into these virtual rainforests or beaches, and we discovered that the restorative response that we got from people after 10 minutes of exposure to those environments was at least as big as what others had reported after exposure to real natural environments, something like a walk in the woods. So it doesn't necessarily have to be real to have the kinds of effects that have been measured. It has to have the right properties.
That is so great, because I have fake flowers on my desk. They're doing much better than the real plant.
That works.
It really does.
We'll be right back after these words. This is Amy Alcon's Human Lab on blogtalkradio.com. I'm back with my guest, cognitive neuroscientist Colin Ellard. We're discussing his new book, which I really recommend, Places of the Heart, The Psychogeography of Everyday Life.
So the late, very sweet Dennis Dutton wrote a book about the sort of environment we tend to prefer. And you write about this. You're quoting Nico Tinbergen on the crucial element in habitat selection for an animal, which you quote him, it's to see and not be seen. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, you're right. Nico Tinbergen was one of the first people to talk about habitat selection in those kinds of terms. And you can see evidence for that in all kinds of animals. The person who kind of translated that into human terms was a fellow named Jay Appleton, who was a geographer by training. But he basically stood on Tinbergen's shoulders and said, okay, in the human environment, how do we think of seeing and not being seen? And he put it in terms of what he called the duality of prospect and refuge. And the idea is pretty simple. We tend to prefer to be in locations where we have both high refuge, which means that we have the feeling of security and protection. So that can come from anything from being in a particular place in a built environment to even something like sitting in a wingback chair will give you that kind of feeling of protection. Sometimes I think that's why wingback chairs seem to never have gone out of style. But at the same time, we also like to have prospect. So we like to be able to look out on a vista and see what's there, what's coming, what's available. And Appleton put this very much in kind of evolutionary psychology terms in the sense that he said it makes perfect sense for human beings, just like everything else, like animals that want to see and not be seen, to prefer these kinds of locations, because that would have been key to our survival. What's interesting about that from a modern perspective is that, you know, the contingencies that operate in modern environments are usually pretty different. Mostly, we don't have to worry about being attacked by predators or enemies when we're hanging out in a restaurant or a city square. And we don't have to worry about looking for a good forage or anything like that. But nevertheless, we still seem to have these preferences for high prospect and high refuge. And you can see that in anything from the kinds of places that we might like to rest in our homes to, if you watch people's behavior in public spaces, again, like public squares, you seldom see people standing smack in the middle of a public square. You see them inhabit the margins, the edges. Those are the really nice places. If you watch how people, when they can seat themselves in bars and restaurants, where they go, again, it's relatively rare to see someone go sit in the middle of a space like that if they have a choice. They're much more likely to inhabit the margins. And I think all of that comes from this duality of prospect and refuge that Jay Appleton first described, but that harkens back to our early origins and that we share with all kinds of animals.
It's so, so fascinating. I love that. And you point out in your book that we are no safer at the edge of a public square than in the center, which is just so true. And by the way, just for people listening, I remember these Prospect and Refuge, which I just read in your book. It's not like I knew them, but Prospect is to see and Refuge is to not be seen. And it really does make evolutionary sense. So you reference psychologists Stephen and Rachel Kaplan, and they note that our attention is different in modern settings versus natural environments. How so?
Well, if you think about how you deploy attention in your everyday kind of life, imagine something like walking down a city street. You are making kind of a hard focus on particular events and locations in that environment. So as you're, say, thinking about getting ready to cross a street, you're, of course, paying very close attention to things like the traffic signals, oncoming cars, maybe where other pedestrians are. You've got a really kind of hard, fixed focus on those things. And that's, in our modern life, that's actually the way that our attentional processes are working most of the time. And one of the things about that is that, as everybody knows, that gets really quite exhausting. We know that our cognitive resources, we say that they become depleted. So it becomes harder and harder for us to maintain that kind of fixed focus. When we go into a natural setting, then an entirely different set of things start to happen to our minds, and particularly the way that we pay attention to things. So now imagine walking through a forest and the way that you're attending. You are certainly paying attention to things, but there's kind of an effortless shift of attention from one thing to another. Environmental psychologists sometimes talk about something that they call fascination, and that's part of it. It's just kind of this effortless flitting of attention from one place to another. So nothing is crying out and demanding your attention as it might on a city street, but lots of things are interesting you to some degree. And that's an important part of this restorative response. It's refreshing, and there are lots of experiments that suggest that those kinds of experiences actually renew these cognitive resources that are depleted when we're in, for example, an urban environment.
Now, maybe this doesn't count because it is a place in an urban environment, but I find that it helps when I write to have enough distraction. So to be in a cafe, but to have headphones on and be seeing people come in, different people, you know, have stuff going on. And so does that count, or is that something different?
I think it might be something a little bit different, because in that kind of situation, you're not being exposed to those kinds of specialized properties that you see in natural environments. But I think what you may be responding to is something else that's really important in urban environments, and really in all kinds of environments, and that is our thirst for complexity. You know, and again, this is something that we share with all kinds of other animals. There have been experiments in everything from rats through to cockroaches and of course human beings, showing that one of the things that we all share is that we're driven to seek out new information. And when that desire for the new, for newness, for novelty, for complexity is thwarted, then bad things can happen to us. We become bored, for one thing, and that boredom involves all kinds of even physiological processes and stressful processes as well. So I think maybe in that cafe situation, what's happening is that you're kind of getting into the sweet spot for complexity, which may be visual. It may be auditory. I know that some people these days even use, I think there are apps that you can have on your computer that simulate the sound of a coffee shop that you could have in your office. And I think that's part of our need to get into the sweet spot for complexity, which makes us feel happy.
I love that. I have a need to not feel really stupid. So there's a conflict there. I love how you wrote about boring places. Your book is so great. And you wrote about, tell us what's wrong with the Whole Foods store in Lower Manhattan, which is the neighborhood I lived in before Tribeca. It's sort of NoHo.
Yeah. Oh, dear. The poor Whole Foods. I've been talking about that Whole Foods store a lot. But it's So I'll tell you what we did. We did an experiment in New York. I do a lot of experiments where I take people for walks, and I wire them up with a few sensors so I can measure their levels of physiological arousal. It's kind of like a stress response. And I ask them a lot of questions, a lot of kind of self-assessment questions. How do you feel? Do you feel good? Are you interested? And so on and so forth. And the study that you're talking about was actually the first one of these. It was done in the Lower East Side, and we had a series of locations that we laid out to look at different kinds of contrasts. And one of the things that I'm really interested in is the design of facades, you know, the skins of buildings and how that affects how you feel and what you do. And so we picked a couple of building facades that had starkly different styles. One of them was the Whole Foods store, which is, as I'm sure you remember, basically a block-long blank facade. There is nothing to see. There's glass, but the glass is frosted, so you can't see inside the store. It's pretty bleak. And then on the same street, but just a block away, there's a series of small establishments. There's a bodega. There's a few bars and restaurants. And it's open, there's lots to see, there are doorways, there are throngs of people. And so we compared what was happening to people's minds and bodies in those two locations. And for the Whole Foods store, the story was not a good one. People were not happy there. When we measured their physiological arousal levels, they basically just hit the floor. They were just showing every sign of being bored to tears. And one of the interesting things about boredom is that we know from other kinds of research that it's actually stressful. Boredom will, again, increase the levels of cortisol in your body. And it will also do other things. You know, for example, one of the I'm not saying that walking past a Whole Foods store all by itself is going to do this, but we know that boredom, for example, increases the likelihood of relapse in people who are suffering from addictions. So, again, one building facade is not going to do this, but the cumulative effect of poorly designed building facades that have low complexity and don't engage the pedestrian is going to overall have a negative effect on people's mental and their physical health.
This is also fascinating. We are almost out of time, which is very distressing. So I want to ask you, so we make sure we fit it in, can you give us some tips to make our home environments and our lives more in tune with human psychology?
Sure. I guess the place I would start would be to think about the design of the interior of your home. And I know that lots of people, in fact, most people don't have the latitude to make a lot of really wholesale redesigns of their living spaces. But a simple thing that you can do, we already talked a bit about this, is to have some reflections of nature in your home environment. And that can be a potted plant. It can be photographs or paintings of nature scenes on your walls. That's something that's pretty simple that no matter where you're living, most people can manage to do some of that. And that's going to actually have a positive effect on your psychological health. I think in the wider world, you know, outside of your home, one of the most important things is to try to be a little bit more mindful of the impact of your surroundings on your psychology. In part, that's one of the main reasons that I wrote this book, and it's also one of the things that drives a lot of the research that I do, again, especially these walking experiments, is that I want people to understand that their environments affect them. And given that knowledge, think about how they can change their behavior to find lively, engaging facades, to find ways to experience nature. You know, one of my fondest stories from my walking research comes from a lady in New York who told me that she walked from Midtown to the Lower East Side every day to do some shopping. And one of the stops on our walk was through this beautiful community garden that she hadn't known was there. And she said, having gone into this garden and having felt the effects and reflected on them, she now had decided that every single day she was going to walk through this garden on her way to her shopping areas. So I think, you know, it's within our hands to change our behavior. But until we are a little bit more mindful and reflect on these connections between environment and psychology, we're maybe not as motivated to do that as we could be. So pay attention to your surroundings and adapt your behavior to promote your own psychological health.
Now, I think that's so important, and I love your book. This is Amy Alcon's Human Lab, The Science Between Us. My guest tonight has been cognitive neuroscientist Dr. Colin Ellard. His new book is Places of the Heart, The Psychogeography of Everyday Life. Thank you. That was just such an interesting and helpful show. I'm going to go buy another plant.
You are very welcome. My pleasure.